Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, Cynical listeners. Before we get started, I wanted to let you know that Jeremy and I will be doing a live show with our friends from the China Institute in New York on Monday, October 9th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. We'll be chatting with Gary Liu, CEO of the South China Morning Post. Gary comes from the tech world. He was formerly CEO of Dig, and before that was the head of Spotify Labs. We'll be talking to him about the challenges he faces, not only steering a venerable old newspaper in difficult times, but also about pressures that the SAMP may be coming under from Beijing and from the new owner of Hong Kong's storied paper of record, Alibaba. Tickets are $10 for China Institute members, $5 for students, and $20 for non-members. Look for the registration link on our website or in the SubChina newsletter, and hope to see you in New York at the China Institute on Monday, October 9th. Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way to keep on top of the latest news from China in just a few minutes a day with our free email newsletter, our handy smartphone app, and of course, straight from the tap at our website, subchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and today I'm in Washington, D.C. for the first in a batch of podcasts we're recording from here in Beijing. Joining me from his uncle's place in Austin, Texas. Are you at your uncle's place, Jeremy?
I'm not right now. I mean, he lives in Austin, but we are, in fact, staying nearby at an Airbnb because my parents are in town and there's a clan gathering.
Okay, well, that, of course, was Jeremy Goldcorn. Jeremy, I trust you are enjoying at least a little fine Texas barbecue and some good music down there?
Yes, and, of course, great Tex-Mex food.
Yeah, you make sure to try a place called the Salt Lick. It's a really kind of legendary barbecue place out there.
Okay, I will.
Anyway,
So, Kaiser, I just wanted to kind of say something about supchina.com. I think we got an email, I'm not sure if you saw it earlier today or yesterday, from somebody who's been listening to our podcast for a long time and had assumed that our website was subchina, as in submarine. So I'd just like to make it clear for anyone listening, it's supchina, as in supper, or what's up, not subchina.
Right.
Because we're hopefully not... Under China.
In fact, we're on top of it, as it were.
We are on top of it.
That's the whole idea.
Well,
anyway, let's jump right in here now. Last month, it emerged that the Cambridge University Press had acquiesced to a request from Beijing to censor a large number of articles and book reviews from one of the prestigious journals that it publishes, the China Quarterly. What happened next, at least as far as the headlines were concerned, was there were angry shouts from the ivory tower, and then Cambridge University Press reversed itself and made the blocked articles actually free to access, to boot. One of the angry voices from the ivory tower belonged to our good friend Jim Millward, historian at Georgetown, in whose living room I now sit. Jim wrote one of the first angry responses to the Cambridge University Press's decision. And since he caught the scent of blood for reasons I'm going to leave to him to explain, he's been hot on the trail, along with some other scholars whom censorship sleuths. And it turns out that what happened at the China Quarterly may have only been the tip of an iceberg, and that the icy hand of censorship, to borrow a phrase from my friend Jeremy there, had reached out for quite a number of other publishers and journals and even databases. So today we're delighted to be back in your home, Jim, to explore this issue with you. So welcome back to Cynica, man.
And welcome back to my home. You're always welcome here, and I'm pleased to be on the show.
Yeah, Shea Millward is my home away from home when I'm in Beijing. So let's.
And thank you for having my voice in your house, Jim. Appreciate that.
Well,
too.
You're welcome too, Jeremy. Anytime.
Your disembodied voice is.
I know a lot of people find that rather annoying. So
I have never heard that. I think I love your voice. Anyway, let's start off by trying to get a sense of just what happened. The situation started off pretty straightforward, at least from where I sit, as one, you know, accustomed to having to deal with censorship requests from the Chinese government because of my former job. But then it got a whole lot more involved. At first, we were aware of just one academic journal, like China Quarterly, but there, I guess there's more to it than just that, and we'll see. How did you first learn, or how did, you know, the public first learn that Cambridge had assented to this censorship request in the first place?
Well, it was back in the middle of August, August 17th, and news went around on a sort of email list of China scholars that I'm on. And people said, hey, did you see Tom Pringle's letter? And Tom Pringle's the editor of the China Quarterly. And he had written a letter to the editorial board of that journal announcing that Cambridge Press had been asked to remove some 300 articles from the database version of the journal as it existed in China. And it had agreed to do that. And so Tom Pringle provided a factual letter about this, but he also sort of expressed some opinion. You know, he obviously wasn't too pleased with this turn of events. And of course, when the China studies community heard about it, there was a lot of outcry that began sort of right away.
Jim, can I interrupt at this point and just clarify that this censorship, it only applied to people accessing the database from within China without a VPN, right? It was, they didn't actually delete anything available to people outside of China.
Right. What I gathered was going, see, I was not in China to check it. Ian Johnson, the New York Times reporter, did try to get to some things, but I'm not sure if he actually had the, you know, the exact circumstances where this would apply, which would be, I believe, someone in a Chinese university, a university that subscribes to Cambridge's database, then trying to go in and get it, you know, as part of the articles that Cambridge would have provided. So no, Cambridge wasn't cutting it from the database as generally available outside of China. This was just for within China.
So August 17th, Pringle's letter goes out and you guys all see a copy of this. And then...
So then sort of various things happen. It's kind of interesting because this is a story of a new development in, I suppose, the ongoing narrative of Chinese censorship, I suppose. It's also a story of a very rapid international reaction from the academic community to this news, and one that takes advantage of social media and various kinds of new internet tools, which I suppose university professors are not generally thought to be very savvy with. But in any case, there was discussions. It came out very soon after that. There was a statement of dismay and disapproval, which was tweeted by Jessica Chun Weiss and Greg Distelhorst, who are both China scholars. And by the next day, Saturday, there was also a petition going around, or sort of Friday and Saturday, somewhere in there, there was a petition running around on change.org, which had been started by Christopher Balding, who teaches in China. And I wrote my sort of open letter on Saturday, and it got up there. So it was on various listservs that where China issues are discussed.
So Jim, do we know when the censorship request was actually made? Or anything about the internal process by which the decision to acquiesce was reached? Is there one villain in this?
So there's been various unclear reports. And one thing I want to speak more about in a minute maybe is sort of the general approach that Cambridge University Press has had on this. It hasn't been very transparent, and what news has come out has dripped out, and it's generally been leaked, and then they've begrudgingly confirmed it. A story just came out in early September in The Guardian, in which a Cambridge Press spokesman said that it was in late July, early August, that the touch first came in, that the request came in. And it came from, as they put it, an importer who deals with the importing of products such as Cambridge's database, but that the importer had been informed or required by China's General Administration on Press and Publications.
Right.
To make this request of Cambridge. So it sounds like this was a fairly recent, that is, you know, sort of midsummer kind of thing. But Tom Pringle's original letter implied that some months ago, Cambridge Press had already been asked and had complied to remove some 1,000 books from its ebook marketplace in China. And we've heard no more about that, and Cambridge hasn't confirmed exactly what that is. There's been no list of that that's been released, but that was in Tom Pringle's original letter and is also of concern here.
So was there any actual notification by China Quarterly or by the Cambridge University Press of the authors of these papers and of these reviews, or of the books that were originally for sale in the ebook marketplace, that their works had been blocked or had been removed from the database?
So as far as I know, no. I didn't have an article in China Quarterly that was affected, but a book of mine, a review of a book of mine, was in that list, and I was not told anything about it. But as far as I know, no, they didn't correspond with the authors before making this decision, which is, of course, one of the things that was of great concern. But events were moving quite quickly, and by that Monday morning, Cambridge released another statement through Tom Pringle again, saying that Cambridge Press had reversed its decision to pull those 300 articles from the database of China Quarterly and would restore them and would actually make that group of articles available free of charge somewhere on its database.
Right. Were they free to those of us outside the Great Firewall?
I have to say, I didn't check.
More importantly, that's funny.
Jim, how would you characterize the reaction from the scholarly community on this? Was it pretty unanimous in its criticism? Or were there people who were willing to defend the CUP decision?
Well, that's a good question. I would say it was strongly, the majority of responses were that this was, you know, a very bad decision. Certainly the public responses were all, decrying the decision. In some of the discussion, people raised the issue that, well, this is a tough situation that Cambridge is in. And Cambridge itself, in its first statement on this, it set up the issue this way. It said that in order to maintain the availability of the rest of its materials, they had agreed to acquiesce to this demand to remove a relatively small number of articles. And that's the kind of argument that we've heard.
Yeah, it's the classic censorship conundrum, right?
I guess. And it's something that comes up in translations of books. If your book is going to be translated into Chinese, the Chinese press, there's a reference to Tiananmen in there, or you say something about Deng Xiaoping, they feel that you can't publish with that. But if you take that out, the rest of the book can be published in Chinese.
Big debate over that a couple of years ago. We'll get into that later on, when we get into sort of the more philosophical stuff. But let's first unpack what actually happened here. So, Jim, you're a mild-mannered guy. I mean, why did this particular issue grab a hold of you like it did? I mean, we were talking earlier, and you said something I thought was really interesting, that it's not really just about China, that, if China somehow found a way to block or to deep six the articles in question, that would be regrettable, but it wouldn't prompt you to write an angry open letter on Medium. So which got you so steamed up? I mean, what made you go all full Philip Marlowe on this?
Well, a couple of things. If anyone reads my open letter about this on Medium, you may think this is a distinction without a difference. But I do see myself as speaking really to Cambridge Press in this case, and by extension to academic institutions of all sorts outside of authoritarian areas, and not speaking so much to China and decrying Chinese censorship, which I obviously think is a bad idea. It's not good for Chinese scholarship and growing the importance of Chinese universities globally and so on and so forth. But this particular issue did get me fired up, as you said, because I've seen this kind of thing before in a variety of contexts. I have a personal history, which I think we've talked about on your podcast before, of having visas blocked because of my participation in a book about Xinjiang. And again, it was regrettable, and I was very upset that the Chinese Foreign Ministry chose not to give me a visa on a couple of occasions. But I was really upset with my own institution, Georgetown University, for what I saw as a very lame reaction. And not just Georgetown, but several universities, because there was a bunch of scholars who were involved at the exact same time. And so-called Xinjiang 13, which really doesn't involve 13, but people who had written in a book edited by Frederick Starr called Xinjiang, China's Muslims Frontier. And this was now some 15 years ago or so. I've written about that in a piece with China Beat. People can look up. It's called Being Blacklisted in China and What I Learned from It. But that experience sort of showed me a couple of things. I felt very strongly at the time that a robust collective response by the universities involved, Georgetown, MIT, Dartmouth, Miami University of Ohio, there were some, you know, big name universities, would definitely have changed the situation. But there was no interest on the part of any of our administrations in our universities to do anything about that. And within my own university, we had just started, just embarked upon a relationship with the Chinese Party School. And I suggested at the time that, well, if we know these people in the party school, there's some potential Guanxi there, there's some connections there. Why don't we see what they say? And I was told at the time that it was a non-starter. But we hear these stories about campuses in China or concerns about Confucius Institutes and so on. I also heard just last year of a case of a American citizen student at an American university, but of Uyghur descent. And she had actually been the best Chinese student in her Chinese class, which was sponsored by a Confucius Institute in the U.S. She won the scholarship for a semester study in China of Chinese. And she actually learned Chinese here. She didn't start speaking it. But once her visa application went in with the other students, she never got any, she never got visa back, never got any news. She simply wasn't able to take up this scholarship.
Wow.
And her university, you know, she asked what's up, you know, and the time for her to go and matriculate came and went. And her university basically said, geez, I'm sorry, nothing we can do. And she couldn't even attend classes at her own home institution here in the U.S. because, you know, the time to register and so on had gone by. She was basically just condemned to, you know, sit out a semester.
This is ridiculous.
So I heard about this and...
Is there evidence to suggest that it was just because, I mean, she had a recognizably Uyghur surname?
The other students from the university and others on that scholarship program all got their visas and went.
Wow.
And, you know, you have to put down on your application if you have relatives in China and who your relatives are and that kind of information. So the, you know, the speculation, or not speculation, the pretty reasonable conclusion, assumption is that it was because of her Uyghur background. Okay. So anyway, this... reaction, which simply was basically to say, tough luck. Again, one can deplore China doing it, but the American institution actually could have done something else about it. And in the end, a bunch of us wrote letters and we kept it pretty quiet, but the student was able to go and do a program in Taiwan instead, and the university paid for it. So in any case, so that crystallized another issue for me too, and that is that the academic institutions themselves, be they universities, be they publishers, as in the case of Cambridge Press, be they grant agencies, do have a way to do something when these things come up, not simply to shrug. And that is to try and find workarounds, try and find ways in which they can help the student or the researcher to carry out some kind of valuable research, maybe not in China, or maybe not using the particular materials, or, you know, whatever the case is, but should be actively thinking of ways to do that. And this would not necessarily undermine their own, you know, China engagement. So in the case of a publisher like Cambridge Press, obviously to actively acquiesce to cutting your own materials, there should be other ways in which they could handle this situation.
Right. Right, right. I mean, they're obliged to. It's not just that they can. They really
ought
to. Well,
exactly. Right. And that's, of course, you know, that's sort of leaving aside the broader issue of, you know, academic freedom in general and a renowned institution such as Cambridge University and its press should not be involved in censoring at all.
Jim, can we talk about the content of the articles and book reviews that were identified by the Chinese authorities for removal? There's been some analysis of the pieces. What did it show?
As many of your listeners might expect, there were certain topics, you know, the kind of old standard topics that seemed to be the ones that were singled out. So
the three T's and an F.
Yeah, right.
Well, and a few more, right? So Taiwan, Tibet, Tiananmen, Hong Kong, Xinjiang issues and Uyghur issues, obviously Dalai Lama, certain articles about Chinese leaders and about elite politics. And that was pretty much the list.
So no huge surprises there.
No huge surprises.
No, one was the Cultural Revolution.
That was a big one as well.
Yeah,
yes.
That was an odd one, though. I mean, this is the first time I've seen them get quite so prickly over discussion of the Cultural Revolution, which I thought
mm-hmm,
was...
Mm-hmm. And one thing that emerged from that is that it's pretty clear that this list was generated initially simply by keyword searches.
Right.
Right, on the database. And that raises another issue, too, but sort of the ease in which this kind of thing can be done now in a digital space.
So what's interesting is how this expanded beyond just the China Quarterly. So let's talk about some of the other journals and some of the other databases that you discovered along the way were actually being asked to censor as well, and what their reactions were.
Right. So on that Monday after this came out, Cambridge reversed itself, and that same day we found out that the Journal of Asian Studies, which is the flagship journal of the Association of Asian Studies, which is the largest American academic association dealing with Asia, and it has a lot of international reach as well, that their journal too, which is also published by Cambridge Press, had been asked to remove some 100 articles from the database, or that Cambridge had told JAS that it had been asked. In this case, it seems that the articles had not actually been removed yet, and Cambridge reversed itself, you know, right at that same time. But again, Cambridge didn't tell us this. It came out from the board of the Journal of Asian Studies itself. So, you know, one really would have wished that once it reversed itself, Cambridge had just come clean, had, you know, thrown open the shades and told us everything that was going on.
But they didn't do that. You had to drag it out of them.
Well, this finally came out after a lot of discussion from the board of the Association of Asian Studies themselves. And they, you know, they took some time to do it. I was a little critical on Twitter of them, but I understand their concerns. They didn't want to just throw out, you know, this list of articles. So instead, they released a analysis of the topics of the articles that had been on the list. And that was, I presume, to protect some of the authors, perhaps, from kind of secondary persecution. Obviously, the list was generated in China. So someone in China, you know, knew this list, and arguably having it republished abroad wouldn't make that much difference. But China is not a monolith. And so, you know, the General Administration of Press and Publications would not be sending this list around to local units in China. And this is actually an important thing to remember, that when this kind of censorship happens, or when a visa block happens or something like that at a central level, it's not common knowledge even among people in the same, you know, right, business around China. It's actually kept very close to the chest in those central organs that do it.
That's right.
So JAS was involved, and they finally, you know, admitted it. I was asking around trying to see if any other journals were
involved. JAS being the Journal of Asian Studies.
Journal of Asian Studies, right. Was involved. They never actually pulled those articles, but they had been asked to. As far as we know, the China Journal, which is another prominent journal of contemporary Chinese studies, was not asked to remove any articles. So they are published by Chicago University Press. And again, as far as we know, they were not subjected to this kind of demand from GAPP. But we
figure
found
the Brits cave easily.
Well, I think there's various reasons for this. Possibly Chicago doesn't have the kind of large presence.
Right.
Publishing and, in particular, you know, e-marketing presence in China that
Cambridge
does,
right?
It's more or less an academic press.
What about like LexisNexis or
JSTOR? So LexisNexis, there was a very brief report from Reuters. It came out, again, a few days after all of this broke. And they said that they had been asked to remove articles from their database back in March of 2017. And in response to that, they had not agreed, but they had ended up removing two of their products from the Chinese marketplace. So LexisNexis has various ways of slicing and dicing its legal and news databases. They removed Nexus and LexisNexis. So that means they removed the standalone news database and the legal plus news database.
Right.
Sounds like they left the legal database, and they may have other products as well. I was trying to get more information on this. I was particularly interested in how exactly LexisNexis was asked to remove articles, because it's one thing to go to Cambridge University Press or to a journal to go through their, you know, to do a keyword search on the words in titles and abstracts and generate a list of articles. But to do that for LexisNexis, which has many, many times more pieces in their database, that would be a huge list. And so I was curious to see whether they had actually been asked to block certain keywords directly. I haven't heard back from their communications people at LexisNexis, though, despite repeated calls.
So how would you view something like this? I mean, the decision to just remove whole categories of product. I mean, is that a principled stand, or is it another form of acquiescence?
Well, again, that was something I would have liked to hear. LexisNexis's statement was very carefully worded, and they didn't want to get into details of this interaction. Nobody seems to, but I think those details would be very useful to know. Was this a case of, I'm going to break up with you before you break up with me? did they remove it before it was banned? Or did they take a principled stance? If they did, they didn't announce it, right? The news kind of dripped out from them as well. I mean, it's really interesting. And this is the thing that you're asking what gets me fired up. You can hear me getting fired up now.
This is Jim fired up.
It's the... Can you tell? Yeah. The levels aren't moving on your microphone.
They are. They really are. I mean, it's clipping all over the place.
But this is what gets me fired up. That is that these institutions seem so unwilling to, put their head above the parapet and say anything about this and actually reveal what's going on. And I think if they did that, and particularly if they did that collectively, looked around and found out who else was affected, that this could really be a strong deterrent against future requests like this. Because Perry Link wrote an interesting piece in the New York Review of Books a few days ago, in which he talked about how censorship is done within the publishing world in China. And he pointed out that a phone call is the usual vector, right? The authorities will make a phone call to the editor of a publication and say, don't publish such and such, or don't talk about such and such. They don't want a paper trail of these particular requests. And so the very act of, revealing that paper trail or that email trail or that process whereby the demand was delivered to foreign institutions by the importer, revealing that would actually also be very, very helpful, because, ripping the Band-Aid off and throwing open the shades would, let more sunshine and oxygen in on this.
So Jim, as a professor of history whose focus has been on Qing Inner Asia, I mean, you're obviously no stranger to the way that academics can be, highly political. And in fairness, this isn't something at all unique to the CCP. So let's get into the sort of the deeper whys. And I know that you're not a specialist on elite politics, and I know that this touches on it, but it seems, I think it's pretty clear, they've been a whole lot more heavy-handed in recent years. I mean, the level of censoriousness has risen a lot, and it's been often directed at the universities. There's that famous document number 9, which started talking about the teaching of universal values in the Chinese classroom, and there's been a lot of that recently that we've all read about. Specifically with history, history is just such an easily politicized thing in China as elsewhere, but recently you have this charge of historical nihilism constantly being thrown around by the party faithful. Why do you suppose it's gotten worse? I mean, do you have any kind of working theory as to what's happening here? I mean, is it just that the walls that used to sort of effectively separate communities of scholars between China and the outside world have gotten a whole lot more porous or have come down? Or is it just this whole internet thing? What do you think is
that? Yeah, well, so obviously this seems to be part of a pattern, broader pattern of Xi Jinping's government's, crackdown on academic freedoms and press freedoms and so on. I think, like the decision now to really go after VPNs, like the sort of ratcheting up of kind of controls in general, I think some of it may be that there's a technological cat and mouse game. And at this point, the cat has a bit of the upper hand or an upper paw, and that there are more sort of stronger abilities to actually restrict, for example, access to VPNs.
The Jell-O nailing technology has been perfected.
Yeah, so there might be some of that. And I think here, with regard to the Cambridge Press database, clearly this was, someone realized that they could quite easily come up with a list of sensitive terms and use it to create a list of sensitive articles and then ask Cambridge to do that. More broadly, though, I think there might be perhaps greater anxiety in China about the very openness of its academic system or about the openness of its academic system. That, in fact, has been created by China's investment into that academic system over the last few years.
Huh.
So the universities are now,
success, yeah.
You know, one of the metrics whereby the growth and the improvement of Chinese universities and of Chinese scholarship in general is
numbers
measured.
Of published papers, right?
Published papers in English.
International journals, right?
Participation in international conferences. All of these things are wonderful. And of course, our Chinese colleagues now can, you know, travel abroad pretty much as easily as we can travel to China, sometimes more easily. So there really is opening up a much more unified sphere.
But those pesky flies and mosquitoes come in, right?
Well, right, but people are coming out of the house as well, right?
Right.
The doors and windows are open, and you know, maybe flies, mosquitoes are coming in, but you know, people can go outside.
The domestic flies are excited.
Exactly. So we could take that metaphor, you know, too far, I guess. But
we already have.
So, again, this is simply speculating. So I think part of it is simply the because we can answer, and then the increasing globalization and internationalization of scholarship in China and English ability and so on. You know, that said, in its brief piece about, or brief op-ed about this, Global Times itself said, these are just a few articles in China Quarterly that no one really reads anyway. Which some people have said, you know, a bunch of book reviews, who reads them anyway? So, you know, so there is this kind of question, why the battle about this?
So, Jim, yeah, let's focus in on that a little bit. I mean, this is an obscure journal read by some eggheads. It has a much lower circulation than my Twitter account. You know, why is Beijing getting so bothered over this? And maybe you can talk a little bit about why history and historiography matter so much in China today, and apparently mm-hmm. especially to this leadership.
First of all, a technological question. Sure, China Quarterly itself probably has a very small circulation, but once it's part of these broader databases, such as that of Cambridge Press, such as that of JSTOR, ProQuest, all of these, which Chinese universities now are subscribing to, the question of circulation of an individual journal is no longer important. Access to these articles is there when you search on the broader database. So there may be something, you know, about that that's responsible for this. Mm. The importance of history, obviously, I would say more than any other society. I suppose one could find some other examples here or there, but more than any other society, any other culture, you know, Chinese culture has used history to legitimate the present leadership. And we can see these fights going on in, you know, the earliest of Chinese historical sources. You know, the arguments that we see in, you know, Confucius and Mencius and so on, in particular in the writing of Sima Qian, often known as the, you know, the father of history in China. It's all about commentary on the present, often using the past to do that. And so, you know, this is one thing which anyone who's studied, you know, any Chinese history at all can see very, very clearly, that it matters arguably much more, say, than history does in the United States. Although, of course, right now we're in a moment when we're arguing about our recent history very intensely.
We flicked earlier about the sort of discussion over when censorship may be justifiable, or acquiescence to censorship may be justifiable, as with the authors of books who've agreed to some censorship so that their works get translated into English, removing that page that talks about the Tiananmen demonstrations and the crackdown. Are you a censorship absolutist? And if not, and I assume you're not, how do you figure out the line? How does one come to, you know, I mean, how do you calibrate your compass?
Well, that's a good question, and I can't say I have an absolute answer to it right now. You know, we all make compromises. If you're in someone's living room talking with them, you might not speak as frankly as you would, you know, if they're not in the room. And so if I'm giving a paper in China, I am very aware of my host's position. You know, I'm going to say things in a certain way. So is that self-censorship? Should I decry myself for it? Or is that simply being discreet? Or is that being polite? So everybody has these issues. I think, though, well, there's an easy tendency with this case, or with the case, for example, of Confucius Institutes, for us to see and characterize these changes, or the intensifying urge to censor in China, as this kind of icy hand, as you put it in your introduction, this kind of black shadow seeping out of China and threatening to take over the rest of the world. And I think that's actually the least concern right now. To be sure, if databases are our global repository of knowledge, we don't want to have faulty versions of them floating around. But I think we're, a ways away from that. I think the real thing to be concerned about, and the way to think about this, is from the point of view or, for the sake of our Chinese colleagues. And so I've tried to make that point in my open letter, that to say that, well, for Chinese colleagues, it's good enough to have a scissored up version of the database. It's okay to argue that half a loaf is good enough. I think this really shows a great disdain or sort of disrespect for Chinese scholars.
Yeah, it's condescension.
It's very condescending. So,
but isn't there maybe some postmodern critique that would say there's some relative power relationship that allows the West to privilege its own supposedly objective narrative through this insistence on academic freedom and freedom of information? That's sort of analogous to the way that it's always the rich trading nations that insist on free trade. I mean, that you're dressing this up as freedom of information, but in fact what you're doing is pushing a version of history.
Information imperialism, I think, is the term has been used in China.
Information imperialism, right. The Global Times editorial about this actually sort of raised this in very stark terms and said there's a Western way and there's a Chinese way, and we'll see which one wins in the end. And they asserted that this whole notion of academic freedom was part of a package of institutions and norms that had been imposed by the West and the rest of the world, in the age of imperialism. That's a very tendentious reading of history, because the age of imperialism was full of attempts to crack down on academic freedom outside of, in the West as well. This is an ongoing fight, not simply with Asian or Eastern powers or third world powers. It's an ongoing fight within the West itself. And I think that if anything is a universal value, then the ability to think freely, to write freely, to express yourself freely, is going to be that, because it works against all kinds of abuses of power. And not only that, it's not at all hard to find expressions of academic freedom, desire for academic freedom, for freedom of speech and writing and so on, within the Chinese tradition itself. There's the first emperor of China who wanted to burn the books and bury the scholars.
There's Hao Di who wanted to cut off Sima Qian's nards, right?
Well, and then there's Sima Qian, who ended up allowing his nards, as you so delicately put it, to be cut off in order to continue his history, in which he found ways to make his political points indirectly. And if that's very much a academic freedom position, or Qu Yuan, the great poet who drowned himself in the South. There are many examples of this. So this is not a Western value.
Has had sort of institutional expression in China. It's always been the outlier position. It's never been sort of formalized. It's never been a part of any actual functional state. I mean, that's
right.
It's
not there, on the mastheads.
Right.
Although, I spent a year as a special student doing dissertation research at Renda, at People's, I guess it's called Renmin University in Beijing. And if you go in through the main gate, and I think it's still there now, there's a big rock, which is carved with four characters, painted green, not red, that says, Shi Shi Qiu Shi, seek truth through facts, which seems to me a pretty clear statement of precisely the kind of value that I'm supporting here.
Jim, don't you think that the reason that you're so excited about this, and I also feel fairly strongly about this, is that the Cambridge University Press and, other organizations that may or may not have acquiesced to self-censorship, it's not a company. I mean, if you think of, LinkedIn, for example, censoring what's available on their Chinese version of the site and other internet companies, it's very understandable. This is a for-profit company whose primary duty is to its shareholders and its profits. I think of Peter Hessler talking about these slightly bowdlerized versions of his books published in China, which don't bother me in the slightest, because what makes a Peter Hessler book isn't the commentary on the Chinese government and the Communist Party. It's the record of life as it's lived by Chinese people that he's experienced. But when it comes to an academic institution or an academic publisher like Cambridge University Press, surely their raison d'être is the pursuit of knowledge and truth. And therefore, to censor is a complete negation of what they're supposed to stand for. That's very different from a company or a commercial publisher. Isn't that what is the real
problem
here?
I'm surprised you're letting companies off the hook so easily there, Jeremy, though. I mean, I still expect companies to at least consider that triple bottom line or whatever.
Well, yeah, companies maybe should consider it, but I mean, a company is founded to make money. You know, it's very clear. So I'm not saying they should censor, but if they don't, that's part of their animal nature, because they are for-profit institutions, and the decisions that they make will inevitably be guided, at least partly, by the pursuit of profit. Whereas the Cambridge University Press is not such an institution. It's supposed to be for the
right and
pursuit of
knowledge. As are all so-called academic institutions. I absolutely agree with you, Jeremy. I know that there are many university administrators and people who work for university presses and so on who are very concerned about their bottom lines as well, right? So obviously they find themselves in difficult situations. This raises a broader issue of corporatization of academic institutions in general, one which John Fitzgerald has written about in a very interesting piece in the Financial Review about sort of Australian universities and how a sort of corporatization, particularly of management, replacing faculty governance with business style governance in the university system, has made the Australian universities solvent over the past several years in a way that they weren't before. But at the same time, it has kind of conditioned them to fall into these sorts of dilemmas in dealing with China in a way that sort of, if they remembered their values as a quote unquote pure academic institution, they might not have done.
So, I mean, for me, it's just a function of how big the compromise is and how much good can come of compromise and how much opportunity for good is given up by refusing to compromise. And so, I mean, I can come to a very different conclusion about what the Cambridge University Press did versus what the American Bar Association did, a very different opinion as to whether it was a good thing that Google left China or whether it's a good thing that Facebook, is trying to get into China. I do come to very different conclusions on all of these just based on that sort of a calculus. What is the downside here, though? What's the cost? What's the opportunity cost of taking this principled stance? Maybe this belatedly principled stance. I mean, do any of these database operators, or does the press, or any of these, are they going to lose the opportunity to do some good, to reach?
Well, there's various costs. There's the cost which Cambridge claimed it was trying to avoid when it initially acquiesced to this demand, and that is that other of their products or their database entirely, they'd be completely banned from China. I think they were far too fretful about that. And I think that's very often the case that, a university, is worried to speak up about, if one of its professors is blocked or something like that. They're afraid that China's going to, kick them out of Shanghai and they'd lose their new campus or whatever. I think Western institutions worry about that far, far too much.
Jeremy, how does your calculus work on this stuff?
I mean, I think if you're not a for-profit company, then you should not acquiesce to censorship. I think if you're a for-profit company, I think things get much more complicated because I think you have a duty to your shareholders. And I think that's what you're set up for. That's why you set up a for-profit company.
Would you favor Facebook doing whatever it takes to get into China then?
No, not necessarily. I'm just saying that it's understandable and that not that you shouldn't criticize it if they do it, but that there are where I can understand it and I can see that the situation
that's
is very complicated.
Well, I think you also have to ask yourself, what is Facebook selling versus what are university presses selling, right? And as both of you have pointed out in some of your earlier podcasts about this, there are good alternatives to Facebook in China. So from the Chinese point of view, they can do perfectly well without Facebook, I think. I don't know if you still believe that, but I've certainly heard you say that before.
No, I still do believe it.
Yes, they can. In fact, I could do perfectly well without Facebook if I could only convince the rest of the planet to do without it.
Right, but access, you know, access to the world's, you know, research and social sciences, humanities and sciences is not something we think anybody should really have to, you know, have to do without.
Yeah.
And another thing, I mean, I agree with Jeremy that, you know, universities and university presses and similar institutions, they are not for profit. They are concerned about making money, unfortunately. They have to be. But there's another kind of economy that functions very, very strongly for universities and professors and academic publications. And that's a prestige economy. And, you know, when I publish a book with an academic press, I don't make any money off of it, or very rarely does anyone make money off of academic books. But we do gain a lot in terms of recognition, right? And if you publish with a well-known press, respected press such as Cambridge, then you gain in status. And in fact, this is actually how hiring and promotion is done within the academy. It's not on the basis of, you know, how much money you make. No, certainly not. You know, it is, respected press, peer review, all of this is providing this, you can call it recognition or prestige or whatever you want. But that's really the currency which we function with. And that's what Cambridge was squandering by agreeing to censor its own product, and was also disrespecting the concerns of its own authors, as well as disrespecting the concerns of potential readers and authors in China.
As far as I know, there hasn't been an official reaction in China to the Cambridge decision to reverse itself. Aside from, you know, a predictably silly piece that Kaiser mentioned in the Global Times, and, you know, the Global Times is not, you know, the official voice of China by any means, although it certainly represents a lot of opinions that you will hear from party members, but there doesn't seem to have been an official reaction.
I think there was something like that.
What do you make of this?
Looking today, and it was an article in The Guardian from, I think, September 8th, which was quoting a statement from the Chinese State Council. And they didn't refer specifically to Cambridge Press, but they said that information coming in from outside had to fit the norms of China and the demands of China, and that importers needed to, you know, make sure that, I've forgotten the term of art that they use, but dangerous information was not important. So I think there was an indirect statement from the State Council level, which is quite interesting. We can look that up.
If we find it, we'll put it on the page.
Well, I did want to mention that besides China Quarterly and the Journal of Asian Studies, the American Political Science Review was also on the block, as it were, for some 27 articles. And this only came out very belatedly in the last few days. And again, I'm concerned that Cambridge University Press hasn't made it, you know, clear exactly the extent of, you know, what this ask to censor was. I think it's really incumbent upon them to, you know, reveal how far did it go, what journals were involved, and all of that sort of information.
Yeah, there's been just a pitiably small amount of transparency from many of these publishers. That's really kind of pathetic. Jim, we're going to make sure to put a link to your excellent open letter that you wrote on Medium. And thanks a ton for being so generous with your time. I mean, I'm sure this story is going to play out over the next couple of, well, months and years, and we'll revisit it again. I mean, and this and so many other permutations of this same kind of, you know, censorship conundrum. But again, before we pack up the gear here, let's do some recommendations. What do you say?
Sure.
All right. So before we get to recommendations, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina. Check out the app and subscribe to the newsletter at supchina.com. You can follow SupChina on Twitter at SupChina News and on Facebook, which Jeremy hates, at facebook.com/SupChinaNews. Recommendations. Jeremy, why don't you kick us off?
Well, firstly, I love all of you on Facebook. It's just, I don't really like Facebook, but I'm there and I use it. So my recommendation is connected to today's topic. It's a book by my old teacher, J.M. Coetzee, who is a South African novelist, well, now Australian, who has won the Nobel Prize. There's a really wonderful book of essays called Giving Offense, Essays on Censorship by J.M. Coetzee.
So that's how you say his name.
I was just thinking the same thing.
Coetzee.
I've always said Coetzee.
Yeah, you say Coetzee. Yeah. Yeah, Americans usually say Coetzee, but it's Coetzee. J.M. Coetzee, he wrote his, I think, most important works as an Afrikaans white South African under apartheid. And, we had, when I was growing up, a system that was not dissimilar to China in terms of censorship. Our government actually was so extreme that we didn't have television until I think it was 1978, because the government were worried that communist and satanic influences would destroy the minds of the people. So he knows of what he talks. Giving Offense, Essays on Censorship by J.M. Coetzee.
That's an excellent recommendation. I'll check that out. Jim, what do you have for us?
Well, keeping with the subject of today's discussion, there's an interesting exchange between Evan Asnos and Peter Hessler. Peter Hessler wrote a nice piece in The New Yorker called Travels with My Censor, which really lays out the complexity of the issue. In his case, it was decisions about his book.
Wonderful, Jim, because that's the essay I was referring to earlier.
And in this case, the censor is actually a very sympathetic individual.
Yeah, very much.
And I've had some dealings. One of my books was translated recently, and I had to have some sort of uncomfortable conversations.
Which one?
My Silk Road book.
Oh, okay.
Not about content, because there was nothing in there, censorable, but frankly, whether I should give a little book tour when I was in China recently. And it was decided that because sort of iffy that I would get a visa or not, it would be better if I didn't do a public appearance like that. And I, said, fine. Right. So one of the recommendations is Travels with my censor. And then there's sort of a response, and Hessler, as we've said, decided to allow a small number of cuts in the translation of his book so that the book as a whole, could circulate. And it was indeed very, very popular and I think, interesting to Chinese. And then Evan Asnos, who also had a book about contemporary China, based on his reporting, he decided not to and wrote about it in an op-ed in the New York Times, which one can find, that is, not to publish in China and to accept censorship. And I think, you were asking earlier, Kaiser, if this is an absolute matter, and I think they kind of lay out the sides of the consideration, pretty well, but from the point of view of an author, right, not of a...
Well, I think what Jeremy said in reference to this particular debate was really right on the mark. I mean, that you don't read a Peter Hessler book to see what he says about Tiananmen or what he says about the suppression of dissent or anything like that. You read the Hessler book because he takes you into the mind of an ordinary Chinese person. He's great at giving full color to the lived experience of being Chinese, of an ordinary schmuck in China. It's great. I mean, he's because the prose is so goddamn good. I mean, it's anyway. There's also let me. Let me finish out with this one because there's the Ian Johnson piece about Pete being and then there's our podcast. Jeremy and I talked to Ian about this experience, and about the debate. And he's of course just such a an insightful and sort of observant guy. He had a really great remarks, and so please revisit that podcast, and we'll make sure to put a link.
What a meta recommendation.
Yeah, we're getting way out there. Well, it's all on the same topic. It's all on the sort of the fabled Hessler Asnos debate, which isn't really a debate. I mean, again, I think neither of them would say that they've taken opposite. The approaches that they take are specific to the books that they've written, and they're appropriate in each circumstance. I'm sorry, Jim, you had another recommendation.
And so this is something not to do with censorship at all. It's a musical recommendation. There's a young Chinese musician and composer and performer named Bai Shui,
Bai Kai Shui is his full name.
No, Bai Shui. So you can find him, Baishui, and he's on Spotify and I believe iTunes and various places. And he's Sichuanese. He sort of comes from a Chinese folk music training background. He plays various kinds of flutes, but also guitars and things. But also does abstract music and some electronica and avant-garde kinds of stuff. Some very interesting collaborations with modern dancers. And so there's videos. So he's working in kind of multi, you know, sort of choreography and music. And he's now here in the United States, living in Florida, I believe. And he's performed at South by Southwest a few years ago. So he's now here and kind of making his way. And in fact, Jeremy, I wanted to mention him to your wife at some point.
Because they sounds might like they probably already know each other, but
they might, yeah.
Great. Baishui. I'll check that out. Baishui. Okay.
I will tell her all about him if she doesn't know already.
Excellent. I'm going to follow on with a musical recommendation. A couple of podcasts ago, I confessed to being a total progressive rock head. I was talking about a new book that about the genre of progressive rock. And then a lot of people have sort of contacted me since and saying, hey, can you recommend some bands? And so that's what I'm going to do now. One is the band Porcupine Tree, which is easily one of my favorites. I mean, they're, you know, an update. They're sort of the neo-prog, new progressive rock stuff. I mean, they were really active in the 1990s, but I would especially recommend the albums In Absentia and Dead Wing. And then also the solo albums by, you know, the heart and soul of Porcupine Tree, a guy named Steven Wilson, and two albums I'd single out to recommend for that are The Raven That Refused to Sing and Other Stories and Hand Cannot Erase. He assembles just some of the most amazing musical talents out there. And these albums, not only are they just compositionally great and the musicianship is top notch, but the recording, the studio, the quality of the work is just so, just as a product of a studio. It's like Steely Dan Asia kind of quality of just sparkling and amazing, and everything sounds as it ought to sound. And it's just a joy to listen to for you, people who are into the hi-fi stuff. So, great. Jim, man, once again, thanks so much for having us here, me in corporeal form, and Jeremy as a disembodied voice.
Always Jeremy, happy to speak with both of you, even if you're just disembodied or bodied.
Jeremy, man, good to talk to you. I'll see you soon, I trust.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, y'all take care.
Yeah, y'all take care too.
Well, actually, I guess you're not in Yankee Land if you're in D.C., but yeah.
It's the South. The Cynical Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn. Drop us an email at cynica@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/subchinanews and follow us on Twitter @subchinanews. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. Take care.